The UN is largely a reflection of the world out there, right? And we, as governments, we will either decide to make it effective or we will decide to make it weak. And when we make it weak, we blame it then for why it is that the system doesn't work.
Welcome to Babel, Translating the Middle East, a podcast from the Middle East program at CSIS. Here on Babel, we take you beyond the headlines to take a closer look at what's happening in the Middle East and why it matters. This week on Babel, I speak with Zayd Adad al-Hussein. He's a veteran diplomat, a member of the Jordanian royal family, an international human rights expert, and former United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. We discuss the UN, what human rights look like in a multipolar world, and the role that the UN can play in Gaza. Then I continue the conversation with Natasha Hall and Leah Hickert to explore the importance of codifying human rights into international law and the challenges of sustaining international attention on human rights issues. To translate some of what's happening in the Middle East, this is Babel. Zayd Raad al-Hussein is the president and CEO of the International Peace Institute and Perry Worldhouse Professor of the Practice of Law and Human Rights at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and had two stints as the Jordanian permanent representative to the UN, separated by service as Jordan's ambassador to Washington. Zayd, welcome to Babel.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
You were the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights from 2014 to 2018. Did respect for human rights rise or fall during that time, and why?
Well, it's never binary. You have contradictions, and they abound everywhere in our daily lives. You can look at trends which made you feel that we still were seeing progress on human rights across the world, and many vectors which were positive. And then you saw some very negative trends, the rise of populism, authoritarianism, the willingness to run roughshod over the rights of people seemed to be spreading against the heroism of people on the ground who were fighting in the reverse direction. And seldom do you find rights are just being handed. They have to often be claimed and claimed through struggle. Non-violent always, and it should never descend to confrontation of violence, but there ought to be a struggle for rights where they're denied, whether it be a deprivation of economic, social, cultural rights, or a denial of civil and political rights. That must occur if societies are to remain healthy around the world.
And what's the UN's role in that? What's the UN's opportunity, especially in a world where you have increasing great power competition? Certainly the UN was divided by the Cold War. Now with increasing great power competition, it seems harder and harder to make the UN a place that can really have traction on some of those issues.
Yeah, I mean, the UN is the repository of many of the treaties that are negotiated, signed, adopted, ratified by member states. So without the UN, you don't have a universal norm, a set of universal laws that maintain the standard against which you measure conduct. And so if you were to remove the referee, so to speak, then it would just descend into anarchy. Everyone will have their own set of rules. There won't be a universal standard. So you need to have an anchor in place. The human rights machinery is very sophisticated. We have 9 core human rights treaties. You have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then the 2 international covenants, and then a series of critical treaties and associated sort of instruments, protocols, additional protocols. And all of this is underpinned by the UN. And you have quasi-judicial bodies. You have the Human Rights Council, the Universal Periodic Review. Every country has submitted to 3 cycles of this, including the US under the Trump administration. So the Trump administration, to much fanfare, withdrew from the Human Rights Council, but it did not withdraw from the Universal Periodic Review. And this machinery is essential. It supports civil society at the grassroots level, where civil society exists, and where it doesn't, it'll be the mouthpiece on behalf of civil society. And it's the one thing that sort of allows us to believe that we can be morally consistent. Now, here I have to distinguish between the independent bodies within the UN, my office, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the Special Rapporteurs. These are independent of the member states. And then you have the Human Rights Council, which is intergovernmental, and that is very political. So there you do have double standards abound, and everyone practices it, by the way. Everyone points at the US. Many countries in the global south will point at the US, and rightly so, because they will say, claim that the US champions human rights around the world, but then has, to them, their minds, and the minds of many Arabs, a blind spot when it comes to Israel's conduct. But also, I mean, basically the US can say, well, the rest of you are also practicing double standards, and that is true. The difference being that the US tries to champion the international human rights agenda, and for that reason, there's a sort of special attention given to that particular question.
And China, of course, argues that the United States is advancing its narrow interests, that what the U.S. and its partners put forward as universal values are really just ways to advance Western interests, Western understandings at the expense of countries in the global south. Do you think that argument holds any water?
No. It's an old sort of story, this. This first championed by Mahathir in Malaysia, the old sort of the relativism argument. Look, the Universal Declaration itself came out of a number of different streams. I mean, one of which was a body of philosophers that was put together by ECOSOC at the UN and that canvassed the views of many around the world, including those who were steeped in knowledge about Eastern religions, other religions, not just the monotheistic ones. And it gleaned from all of that that there was significant overlap. And the Universal Declaration reflects much of it. Now, look, there are certain things at the leading edge of the human rights normative framework, you know, whether it's LGBTQ rights or the rights of women in certain contexts, that are considered by some countries to be sort of still too unique and of a nature that's not acceptable to them. It doesn't really vitiate everything else. And besides, societies have to progress. If you're an indigenous community somewhere in South America and you're claiming your rights from a particular government, land rights, rights of indigenous persons, for example, you can't also be then violating the rights of women in your community by causing them harm. Now, one has to respect cultural tradition, cultural rights, of course, that's important, but not at the expense and when it causes harm to others. And so that has to be balanced out. And so the argument, you know, that there are certain things that are entirely Western could be held to be true, but it's a very narrow argument. And everything else, you know, everyone is against torture. I mean, no one stands for torture, right? And who's going to stand for tyranny? Is there a legal or historical tradition that stands for tyranny or supports tyranny? You know, that's what we're talking about, really, in the main. And so there's another point, John, also a friend of mine who was recently the EU ambassador in Washington, Stavros Lambrinidis, who used to be the high representative for human rights in the EU, once said to me, and I think he was absolutely correct, he said, look, you know, when you travel around the world and you go to remand centers or prisons and you meet with prisoners of conscience or political prisoners, you know, never do you hear that argument. Oh, well, you know, it's acceptable to have me in prison because, you know, culturally we're different from the West. The victims of human rights abuses know that rights are universal. You only hear this argument from those who support the oppression or the suppression of dissent or the rights of others. And if you hear it from governments, you hear it from those who are enablers of that condition, but you never hear it from the victims.
And in practical terms, how does the UN have to change to be more effective advancing those kinds of interests in countries where they're not widely adhered to?
Well, look, you know, this is a debate, but I always believe the UN has to have a strong voice. I mean, I tried to be as strong as I could. It didn't earn me any friends with the governments around the world. When I had my last speech, one of the ambassadors said to me, we really hated you, but you were fair. You were tough on all of us, all the countries of the global north, south, the P5, everyone. And I think that was the way the job had to be done, because you need a referee. You need a referee. You need an independent body brave enough to say, look, you're all committing violations and fouls against each other. You have to stop it. And of course, no one likes a referee. Take any of the professional leagues. I mean, you see them constantly being abused by the fans, right? But without them, the game wouldn't exist. And you have a set of rules, normative rules, and you must have a referee backing them up. Otherwise, it becomes the US accusing the Russians accusing the US, everyone's accusing each other of double standards, and you're not agreed on the basics here. And everyone likes to have a weak referee because then you can get away with more, but it's not good for the health of the planet. And that's where we are now. And if we have a weak UN, because the Security Council is divided, it's believed that the senior leadership isn't as strong as it ought to be, then it's not of any service to the member states. And it should be, you know, it should be. And the independent part of the UN has to be strong. The intergovernmental part has to give it power to be strong. Again, going back to, you know, a professional league, the power of any professional league, sporting league, lies with the franchises, the owners of the franchises, lies with the star players, the huge followings that they have, the money involved, right? And very frequently do people know who the umpires are or the officials are, or the referees are, right? But again, the power in the game is given to them to decide the points, to decide the infractions, and that's how the game functions. If we don't have a world where that happens, then we will have complete chaos and anarchy. And I fear that's where we're heading slowly if we're not able to arrest the current developments.
In a conflict that I know you've thought a lot about, and that's between Israelis and Palestinians, the Israeli claim is that the UN has proven time and time again that it can't be a proper referee in this conflict. And in fact, the UN has been trying to advance peace between Arabs and Israelis for 8 decades, and the peace agreements have been made outside of UN auspices. Do you think the UN needs to play a role, a different role, in Arab-Israeli issues going forward? And how does it build the trust of the antagonists if it is to play a larger role?
Yeah, I'm not sure one agrees with the Israeli assessment, because, I mean, Israel was founded in part on a UN General Assembly resolution.
Which was rejected by the Arab states.
Yeah, and then you had Resolution 242, which basically established the basis for any peace, you know, land for peace, essentially. Right. And that was the rubric that sort of basically, in the context of a peace with the Palestinians, still is the determining rubric. Look, again, John, you have to separate. What do you mean by the UN? Do you mean the Security Council, General Assembly? I mean, they're entirely political bodies, right? And they're not going to be morally consistent. It's not going to be like that. The UN Secretariat ought to be morally consistent and strong. And here, every High Commissioner for Human Rights has been attacked by the Israelis, being referred to as anti-Semites and so forth. And yet we were not, in my case at least, I didn't single out Israel. I was hard on all countries that I felt needed to have the light and spotlight shone on them. In the intergovernmental bodies, in the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council and so forth, there was this claim, and one could hardly dispute it, that there seemed to be an extraordinary attention on Israel, Palestine, and occupation. And what about then the other situations elsewhere that they were seemingly beyond the remit? But there's a reason for that. You know, ask yourself the question, why wasn't Colombia, with 50 years of conflict, ever on the agenda of the Security Council, right? Or Myanmar, why isn't Myanmar on the agenda of the Security Council? It's because the permanent members of the Security Council basically will defend their hemispheres, or will defend their orbits, or will defend the countries within their orbits, or governments within. You know, so it's not a fault of the UN. The UN is largely a reflection of the world out there, right? And we, as governments, we will either decide to make it effective, or we will decide to make it weak. And when we make it weak, we blame it then for why it is that the system that doesn't work. It's like, again, appointing weak referees, and then the game is a chaotic game, and we're blaming the referees. But we appointed the referees. I mean, the whole thing becomes almost laughable if it wasn't so serious. So there is a logic for having a UN that's strong and for holding this world together.
As somebody who's done both bilateral diplomacy and multilateral diplomacy, and you've been involved, as you said, in different parts of the UN, how are the skill sets different, and how do you measure success in those very different realms?
Bilateral work essentially is fairly straightforward. You are there as the envoy of your state and residing in the capital of the state to whom you are accredited. And you have to strengthen, your job is to say, essentially strengthen the ties that connect the two states. And your job is very similar to your counterpart's job. So when I was Jordan's ambassador to the US, my counterpart was the US ambassador in Jordan. And we were essentially doing very similar jobs and often overlapping. That is different from a multilateral diplomat that has to often be in the position of negotiating the two sets, negotiating resolutions often in the General Assembly, which basically are recommendations that states can accept or otherwise. Or you have in the Security Council where it's binding law, the Security Council produces international law that's binding and enforceable. Or you have treaties which also, once ratified and enter into force, then become binding on those countries that have ratified. And it's those latter two categories where the art of diplomacy really shines through. I mean, when you see it practiced at a high level of skill, it's breathtaking. It's brilliant. You know, you ask yourself the question, how do you get agreement on any of these treaties, 193 countries? How can you possibly get them to agree? You know, when you look at parliaments, negotiate budgets, it's almost impossible in many countries to arrive at an agreement, right? And so it's a huge amount of technique and skill required to get that agreement. And it doesn't just come because people agree. It comes through a series of actions by whoever's leading the negotiation to bring them to a consensus at the end. And here, there's certain parts of the UN system where UN is basically the nursery for these treaties. Certain parts of the UN system are really very well developed and strong, and other parts are relatively weak by comparison. And that needs to be changed.
And just to close and bring it back to Gaza, where do you think the UN should be putting its emphasis on Gaza? What pieces of an overall settlement can the UN realistically and practically advance that would bring us closer to an end of violence in Gaza?
Well, the UN recently adopted in the Security Council, the UAE, in the last few days of its presence on the UN Security Council last year, they shepherded a resolution which was adopted and calls for now the opening of a humanitarian space and for the appointment of a senior humanitarian coordinator. The Secretary General has named Sigrid Kaag, a former UN special envoy, very well known to all of us in the UN, did a brilliant job in the removal of chemical weapons from Syria 10 years ago. And so she's been appointed. And the whole sticking issue at the time of the adoption was who would supervise the humanitarian materials going in. And so this is something that was going to be worked out in more detail once she takes up her office. But clearly there's an enormous demand across the world for a ceasefire, because the alternative seems to be that the Palestinian people are squeezed into the strip along the southern coast or southwest coast of Gaza. And ultimately, from the Arab perspective, there's this view that all that Netanyahu has in mind is essentially to empty the Gaza Strip of its inhabitants and have them create conditions that are so adverse that they eventually move into the Sinai, which for the Egyptians is a non-starter. I think the feeling most people have in the region, and I think some in the US also believe this, is that President Biden is enormously popular inside of Israel, and he can change the dynamic. And if he were to articulate before the Knesset, as some have suggested, the importance of now having a clear and determined effort to arrive at a final settlement, then you cannot connect the closure of this enormous attack on Gaza, you cannot have that conclude and then nothing. That it has to conclude, however that is to be determined, and then lead into a peace process. And there are various ideas on the table being discussed as to how one does this, but I think it's Biden more than the UN that can do this. I mean, clearly what's happening in Gaza is absolutely horrific. In the Arab world, I've never seen hatreds that are beginning to emerge and anger as I've seen in the last few months since October the 7th. on the Israeli side, a similar sort of trauma over what happened on October the 7th. I mean, it was savage in the extreme and deserving of condemnation, but the leveling and the destruction and the loss of life and the killing of Palestinian civilians has been horrific in the extreme as well, and really pox on everyone's house. I mean, it's for all of us who believe in peace to see how where we were 25 years ago and now where we are. It's so sad and so awful. And we must find somehow enough threads to stitch together then something that will hold, a peace settlement that will hold, that will give Palestinians their rights on their territory and capital in East Jerusalem, as well as security and a complete security for Israel and Palestinians and all of us who come from that region.
So it sounds like your sense of the UN has a sort of urgent role on the humanitarian side, and there may be a broader political settlement role. But what I heard you saying is a lot of this is going to come down to national governments working with other national governments, not through the UN necessarily.
Well, it often has to come both ways. No, you look on the ground at who emerges from conflicts with a reputation that is intact, that people will support. And then you see whether they can be embroidered into a sort of series of negotiations that will lead you to a settlement. So you need all of it. It's not mutually exclusive. But I think the feeling is that President Biden would have to play a major role if we were to ever see anything emerge from this that's good. The view that we're sort of cresting the crisis, well, it may not be like that. And we have negationist language on both sides. You know, each you have Israeli ministers who basically want to wipe out the Palestinians of Gaza. And then on the Arab side, you have language which basically seems to dismiss the whole notion of an existence of Israel. And so it's very negationist. It's very almost primordial. And that has to be arrested. And surely there's a better way in which we can work our issues. And the sad thing is also over the years, the corrosive effect of settlement building and the occupation itself. You know, I've been saying to my friends that the occupation is not enforced with rose water and ice cream. You know, occupation is enforced through military means. Ultimately, we need peace, all of us. And we need to sort of shock ourselves, perhaps, and maybe this is the shock of what's happening to the people of Gaza and the people who suffered on the Israeli side on the 7th of October. But we need to stop and we need to take stock of what's happening now and begin to thread something together.
And then, of course, one of the challenges for both President Biden and for the Israelis is you may have elections, political changes in both the United States and Israel, which could change the complexion dramatically. And leaders on each side are going to be trying to game the other's politics to use time to their advantage, which makes all of this much more complicated in the months to come.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're balancing on the head of a pin. I mean, it is as dangerous as that. If something happens in the holy site, something violent happens, we're in a different space altogether. So however appalling and dreadful the situation in Gaza, this still could be the opening chapter of something much bigger. And for whatever reason, you could see this spinning in a direction that's frightful. And so I think, again, we must check whatever emotions are likely to come our way and find the space where we can have a discussion with those who want peace on both sides and with the support of the US and a peace based on the basic premise of land for peace and end this conflict once and for all.
Zayd Radel Hussein, thank you for joining us on Babel.
Thank you. Thank you.
Since its creation in 1948, the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has been pretty consistently violated. So what is the value of codifying human rights in international laws and conventions?
I think it's important to have the same rule book, as Zayd was saying. People are always going to cheat, governments will cheat, but at least they know the rules. But there's two main emerging dangers as I see in our world today. I mean, there are many dangers, but two main ones that I see as a challenge to this is disinformation. I think that disinformation basically allows countries to break the rules, but then muddy the waters enough to deny that they ever did anything wrong. And Russia and the Syrian regime obviously did this to tremendous effect in Syria. We're doing a project right now looking at the degradation of norms, including the Chemical Weapons Convention. And what we've found is that a lot of people think that the norm hasn't been broken because Syria and Russia continue to deny and spread disinformation about the usage of chemical weapons. But the problem with that is that they deny doing anything. And to paraphrase the title of Pomerantsev's book on Russian disinformation, if nothing is true, then everything is possible. And that's a really scary proposition, I think. And then the other point that Zaid spoke to is this notion that universal human rights is just a Western concept. This is really troubling because in 1947, the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they came from China, they came from the USSR, they came from the United States, Chile, Lebanon. The vice chair was in fact Chinese. Now, today I don't get worried when governments use that kind of rhetoric because I think that's somewhat to be expected. But I do get a little bit concerned because I see civilians actually taking that in too, as that this is a Western concept. This is the U.S. imposing their hegemony on the world, but they're hypocritical. And I think we need to do sort of a better job at showing how the United States is a standard bearer for that rather than sort of issuing out double standards, because I think a lot of the world sees it that way.
The more concise answer to your question is the measure of the effectiveness of a human rights declaration isn't that everybody always adheres 100%, 100% of the time. But where would we be if we had no rules? It's almost like speed limits. Speed limits on the highway don't keep anybody from going over the speed limit, but it also means that you're not in the Autobahn. You don't have people going 130, 150 miles an hour. Having some limits, having expectations, even if they're not always obeyed, is better than living in a world where there are no limits, there are no expectations.
Western states sometimes enact policies towards the Middle East that account for countries' human rights records, but sometimes they don't. From the perspective of these Western states, is this inconsistency a problem, or is it a tool that they can use to achieve some sort of strategic goal?
I think we should be more even-handed in the way we think about human rights issues in the region. The State Department Human Rights Report certainly is even-handed, but the government as a whole is often very willing to give countries a buy. And sometimes when we have adversarial relations with a country, it tries to use it as a club. I think there's more credibility when you are more even-handed, with the understanding that our foreign policy is about more than human rights, but that we have a deep belief that human rights needs to be integrated into our national interests. In a world in which human rights have greater respect, is a world that not only serves American national interests better, but serves everybody's interests better.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing the consequences of those double standards more than ever today. For 30 years, we've been in a unipolar world, but now there's competition out there. And recent polls in the Arab world have shown that Arabs tend to view Russia and China more favorably than the United States. I mean, will that position change if Russia and China become more integral to policies in the Middle East and conflicts in the Middle East? Yes, I think certainly they will. But today, that's a fact. And that's pretty alarming given the human rights record of Russia and China.
But I honestly don't think, A, that our goal should be to win public opinion in the Arab world. And B, I think there are lots of reasons why, if you look at the World Values Survey, Russia and China are more aligned with much of the mainstream sentiment in the Arab world than the United States is. The Arab world is not a place where there's a huge, widespread importance assigned to individuality and freedom of expression and things like that. So we should accept that the way it is, but also advance our understanding that societies are most resilient when there's greater tolerance, and both work with governments and with populations to try to create more resilience, more tolerance for diversity of views.
Yeah. I mean, I think the "they hate our freedoms" concept is misconstrued. I think, you know, people in the Middle East see Americans as having greater freedoms, but they don't see Americans as committed to sharing those freedoms. I think that's the problem. And again, this goes back to the double standards issue. I think they see U.S. hypocrisy and they get angry with it. They see the United States supporting despots and authoritarian leaders, but then preaching human rights. I think that's the primary issue here. But that said, I think John is right in the sense that our foreign policy does have a human rights component. And I think what scares me about the future is that as we see this multipolar world, there is a danger that in competing with Russia and China, we will sort of let that go by the wayside in order to curry favor with leaders and gain advantage in that competition. And so I do think that human rights are under greater threat than ever before for that very reason.
But I think on the issue of public opinion, in my experience, sure, the United States has been tied to some very unsavory people in the Middle East, but it's really hard to be more patriotic than the president of a country from a U.S. perspective. That is, when the U.S. attacks Egyptian leaders, the Egyptian public rallies around the Egyptian leader, not around the United States attacking the Egyptian leader or in any other country. I think this idea that the United States supports despots and then is opposed by people who want freedom except the United States is keeping them in subjugation, I don't think that's true. I think the reality is that when faced with foreign influence, people rally around a leader. It's very easy for leaders to whip up nationalist sentiment. The question is, can the United States work over time to create incentives for both the government and for a population to engage more, to be more resilient and flexible? I think that's the task we have. But the idea that we're going to isolate leaders and force them from power, the reality is it hasn't happened very often. The aftermath hasn't often been what either we or the target population would like. Look at Iran. I think it's an easy argument, but to me, it's not a very persuasive argument.
Let's pivot and look a little bit at the region right now. I mean, we can see that Gaza has attracted massive worldwide attention, but the atrocities being committed elsewhere in the world, let's say in Sudan, have quickly dropped from the headlines. Similarly, there's almost no attention being paid to the human rights record in Syria after more than a decade of war there. When is it possible to sustain public attention on these human rights crises?
I'm not sure it is. I mean, as someone that's been working on this for a long time, there's so many horrendous conflicts in the region. Recently, IRC put out a paper on crises to watch, and Sudan is actually the first one, not Gaza. Although I would argue that Gaza and the Palestinians are something that the United States has something to do with. But there's so many others. I mean, between 2020 and 2022, over 500,000 non-combatants died in Tigray, Ethiopia. Most people don't know about that. Most people don't know about the massacres that happened after the Rwandan genocide. I interviewed the survivors of those. Nobody knows about the millions of people that died in the Great Lakes region with conflicts that were feeding off of each other for years. So I think it's a really big challenge, and not just for your everyday American. I think it's a challenge for policymakers, for humanitarians too. I mean, I spoke to one of the heads of the humanitarian response in Syria as he was coming into his position, and he admitted to me he thought the war was over. And he got the wake-up call in 2020 when 1 million people were displaced from fighting. But it's really hard to manufacture that wake-up call for ongoing pervasive human rights violations. Predictably, there will be instability and I think violence because of those violations. But, you know, it's really hard to react until that happens. And that is also why I've argued that I think human rights should be a strategic imperative for countries like the United States, because I think that they're a canary in the coal mine for deeper dysfunction in societies. So I think we do need to be a bit better about addressing that before it becomes a full-blown crisis. But that is always the perennial issue.
But it highlights the Israeli puzzlement that the world remains focused on Israel and the Palestinians when there are conflicts all over the world, some of which are much bloodier than the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, with the exception of the current Gaza crisis, which is bloodier than most humanitarians have ever seen in their lifetimes. It's a contained area over a very short period of time. But the broader conflict between Israel and Palestine has sustained global interest. I would argue it's one of the only things that billions of people around the world care deeply about. And there are so many other conflicts, much bloodier, many more deaths, much more displacement. And the world doesn't really care. And part of me understands Israelis' confusion, but part of me also says, you know what? That's the case. It's going to be the case. And that's what you have to deal with. There's something different about the conflict in Israel and Palestine, which in both global history and certainly in the world now, it is a qualitatively different response. And there's no question that Natasha is absolutely right. These things go on for years, decades, and most of the world has simply moved on, doesn't care. And that's not to our interest. And it's not the interest of the people who are suffering. It's not the interest of the United States.
Unfortunately, I think that's true. And I think most of our audience would agree. Thank you for joining me, John and Natasha.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leah.
Thanks for listening to Babbel. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find more analysis on this topic linked in the show notes on the CSIS website, and you can find us on Twitter at CSIS Mideast.